Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. 70 years ago today, the United Nations Charter was signed at the San Francisco War Memorial and Performing Arts Center in California. The Charter is the foundational treaty of the United Nations and was signed by 50 out of 51 signatories. And the goal of the organization, as per that charter, was, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. The very first principle in the UN Charter is to maintain international peace and security, and to that end, to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of threats to the peace and for the suppression of acts of aggression or other breaches of the peace, and to bring about by peaceful means and in conformity with the principles of justice and international law, adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations which might lead to a breach of the peace. By most measures, the United Nations, although noble in its aspirations, has failed to live up to its stated principles. And joining me now to explain how is James Paul. He's a former executive director of Global Policy Forum, and he recently wrote an article for the Interpress Service entitled simply, "The United Nations Disappoints on its 70th Anniversary." Welcome to Uprising, Jim.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Sonali.
Well, the title of your article makes it as clear as possible. Let's first start with history. What were the political issues of the day that led to the formation of the United Nations? And before the UN, we had the League of Nations, right?
Well, the League of Nations, of course, had failed to prevent World War II, but the immediate surrounding situation in the formation of the UN was, of course, the war itself, this tremendous war lasting about 6 years, with so many millions killed, so many millions displaced, and the Holocaust and all the rest. And so the United Nations had been proposed at different times, particularly by Roosevelt and Churchill, in their meetings during the course of the war. It was their way of saying the world after this war is going to be different. Going to be more peaceful, it's going to be more just. And so that is why there was a tremendous amount of public enthusiasm for this, and in a sense that this was the right time and the right thing to do.
So how enthusiastically was the UN's formation met? Were people really idealistic when it was formed? Did they really expect the UN to be able to end war, or at least resolve wars as they break out, in a peaceful manner?
Well, of course, the term United Nations had been originally applied to the Allies in the war. And the sense was that many of the world's most important nations get together and seek an end to conflict, that could be possible. And the sense of the United Nations Charter was that same alliance would stay together and would more or less make sure that there wasn't any future wars of the same kind that had been in World War II. So I think there was a certain enthusiasm at the policy level in Washington, but of course, in Washington in particular, there was also a sense that this was an institution that was going to manage the world in Washington's favor in the post-war period. Naturally, the public, the enthusiasm of the public, and that is sort of somewhat represented by Eleanor Roosevelt and her initiatives around this, the public enthusiasm didn't take into account the fact that there were tremendous interests at stake that were going to be pursuing, let's say, goals that were not going to necessarily lead to peace in the post-war period. And of course, we had the Cold War very soon afterwards.
Now, isn't the United Nations, by its very structure, set up to have the interests of superpowers trump that of smaller nations? We have the General Assembly, which is a very sort of democratic, at least, theoretically democratic institution or body, I should say. But then there's a Security Council that the privileged few powerful countries and then a rotating set of countries have access to trump things that the General Assembly might vote on. Didn't that by itself ensure that the supremacy of superpowers would continue?
Yes, it certainly did. In fact, in the discussions at Dumbarton Oaks, for example, in 1944, when the Soviet Union, the UK, and the US, with also some Chinese participation, started talking about what the UN was really going to look like, the conclusion of those powerful nations was that they would have to have some kind of veto power in the new Security Council. And the others, the smaller countries, and there was 50 altogether, and minus the big five was 45, and most of those 45 were opposed to a veto power, but the veto power was more or less forced down their throat. And this has been the most serious problem in the UN Security Council, and leading to a kind of very despotic way in which policy is conducted in the Council. But we should remember that actually of the five permanent members with veto, it's really two that run the Council, the United States in particular, but also the UK.
Right,
the
of course.
The other three are along for the ride mostly.
And also we've had, I mean, let's briefly talk about the other ways in which the UN has been undermined. For example, the formation and the kind of the turning to of other alternative bodies, NATO, for example, which took over peacekeeping operations in Afghanistan as one example, and then we have the G8 as well. These institutions that are being formed outside and are being used outside the United Nations end up undermining the United Nations. And there's also the issue of a huge lack of funds that the United Nations suffers from. Do those two also contribute to the UN not being able to live up to its charter?
Absolutely. In fact, the business of shifting decision-making outside the UN, the case of the G20 is very interesting because I've always thought that the possibility for clipping the wings, reducing the power of the United States in particular and the P5 in more broadly, could be accomplished with the participation of the second-tier countries. And I'm thinking of Brazil, South Africa, India, Germany, Japan, in particular, and they could have done this, and they still could do it within the UN, but instead they wanted to join the club, and they insisted on having permanent membership in the Security Council for themselves, for example, and they wanted to set up the G20 in order to have to be part of this club like the G7, but somewhat enlarged. So unfortunately, the problem isn't limited to the United States, but the problem goes wider, and there's a certain geostrategic interest that's how states define their role in international politics. And if they were to act somewhat differently, the whole international structure could come up differently. As far as the business of funding is concerned, the UN's budget this year is $2.7 billion for the regular budget. And by comparison, the city of New York's budget is $75
billion. Wow.
The state of New York has more. Of course, the federal budget is gigantic.
So it's crippled by that. We just have about a minute left, Jim, and I just want to briefly ask you as well how the fact that the UN's war prevention efforts, or what it was supposed to be war prevention, has now slowly morphed into war fighting efforts under the auspices of so-called peacekeeping. We hear of peacekeeping missions of the UN in various countries around the world, but in effect, many of them end up doing some sort of war fighting, right?
Absolutely. The UN has more than 100,000 troops in the field. It uses now what are called robust peacekeeping methods. The peacekeeping used to be just, very lightly armed peacekeepers that were interposed between fighting forces. And now UN peacekeeping goes out and tries to win wars in different circumstances. Very often, these peacekeeping missions create more conflict than they solve. And so it's changed the perceptions within the UN Security Council and towards solutions to problems based on the use of force. It's right. A terrible irony that the UN would have been transformed in this particular way.
And we will post a link to your lengthy article in Interpress Service on our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today so our audience can get the fullness of your arguments on this day, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. Jim Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
James Paul is a former executive director of Global Policy Forum, and his article in Interpress Service was entitled The United Nations Disappoints on its 70th Anniversary.